female bees pollinate plants that produce about one-third of the food we eat, one-third. And yet we use pesticides that kill bees to grow the plants that bees pollinate. Kind of a conundrum there, isn't it, folks? And so we wonder, can we grow food with bees and pesticides?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1096th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Fremantle who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Strubia on the boards. Hello, Jason.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So, Jason, we have this really interesting fix that we find ourselves in, whereas we rely on bees for almost one-third of the food we eat. And yet, to grow those plants, that food, we're relying on pesticides that kill the bees. So, what are we going to do?
Hopefully not use more pesticides.
Well, there it is. Folks, the Food Chain Radio's intern producer, Olivia Duncan, will be graduating from the University of California with a degree in environmental studies. As her final assignment for the Food Chain, she was asked to produce a story she believed would be of interest to the public. After some thought, she settled on bees, as she has become acquainted with the honey business while a student studying abroad in New Zealand. So I asked her, bees are very important, but what about them would be interesting enough to capture and hold an audience? She answered, well, bees are responsible for about one-third of the food we eat, but their colonies are collapsing all across the country. I asked, do you think we know why bees are colonies are collapsing? What's going on? She answered, well, a lot of people suspect it's because of the neonicotinoid pesticides we use to grow food. It's the most used pesticide in the world. So I asked, well, we rely on pesticides that kill bees to grow the plants that are pollinated by the bees. Do you think we can make a good story out of that? And she said,
yes.
Yes, okay. Folks, welcome to Olivia Duncan, who is an environmental studies major at the University of California and has been our intern producer here for the last quarter. Olivia, welcome aboard.
Hi.
Hi. Okay, well, let's make a show of this. Pollinators and pesticides. Yeah. Now, you came across bees in New Zealand, right?
Right.
Honey, what were you doing in New Zealand?
Oh, I was studying abroad for the quarter during fall, our summer, their winter, actually. And honey is a significant industry there. So I actually ended up going to a lot of farms, and then I was curious about the production process because it was so particular.
No, okay. So you've been, you were raised in the city. Were you ever that conscious of bees, per se?
Well, where I was raised, while we were in the city, there was also access to those natural resources, so it's not like bees were completely devoid from my upbringing.
But were you aware that they were in danger?
No, definitely not.
Really? So when did you become aware of that?
Well, I think they only officially became endangered, like, in the last few years, so I guess in university.
So when you were in environmental studies, it's something you picked up and said, hey, the bees are in danger.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so here we go. We have a conflict, don't we?
Right.
And can you paraphrase that conflict for us?
Yeah, well, I think you said it pretty well before that we rely on bees to produce a third of our food, but we've also become reliant on pesticides to boost the agricultural production. But the thing is, bees are the only ones in the equation that are actually necessary for our food system.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then some say that pesticides are necessary, too. So we become reliant on both,
yeah.
And both kind of are at war with each other, right?
Exactly.
So that's an interesting fix. Now, you brought us a guest. Who did you bring us a guest? Who's our guest?
Oh, we have Madeline Carnemark. She, she's the Pollinator Program and Policy Coordinator at the Center for Food Safety.
Say hello.
Hi, Madeline.
Hi. Hello. Hi, how are y'all doing?
Very good. Thanks for joining us, Madeline.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
Oh, hi.
Your job, Olivia. Take it over, girl.
Oh. Oh, okay. Well, I guess we're wondering, was I right on the mark with that stuff about bees and our agricultural system? What are your thoughts?
Absolutely. I think, it is a complicated issue. As you said, the current agricultural system that we rely upon is heavily chemically dependent, and obviously that is having a large impact on the bee population and rippling effects throughout the environment. And so I think it's just like you said, bees are really the thing in the equation that we really do need. Pesticides are something that we could avoid using, particularly the insecticides that we're finding to be the most harmful to bee populations. Numerous studies have shown that they're not increasing yield and that they're often used as a prophylactic approach to pest management that isn't necessary in most cases. So we're applying these at rates that are hurting bee populations or hurting our environment, and oftentimes we're not seeing any benefit to using them.
So if there's no benefit, evidently, why are we using them?
Well, they've become something that, particularly so talking about systemic insecticides and neonicotinoids in particular, a leading culprit in bee decline. We use them mostly because they have become something that, because they're systemic, you can apply them to a seed in agricultural uses and use them prior to knowing that you have a pest problem. And so it's sort of an insurance policy of, we're just going to put these chemicals out there with or without the pest problem should one arise. But what we're finding is that we're seeing resistance issues with these chemicals. And again, like I said, they're not necessarily increasing any yield.
Okay, right. I was actually reading, the application for neonicotinoid pesticides is pretty easy compared to a lot of other ones, correct?
I couldn't speak specifically on the application process,
okay.
But...
So can you tell us about the Center for Food Safety? What do you do there?
Absolutely. So the Center for Food Safety is a national environmental NGO, and our mission is to empower people, support farmers, and protect the earth from harmful impacts of industrial agriculture. So I work on our pollinator program, which focuses on we're looking at pollinator decline across the board and what the impacts of our industrial agricultural system are on pollinators. So specifically really looking at the pesticide issue and its role in pollinator decline.
Mm. And who paves the way for the Center for Food Safety?
Paves the way?
Yeah, who pays the way? We always want to know who pays the way.
Absolutely. We have,
Are you getting grants from Monsanto?
No, we are not.
Oh, okay. Who pays your way?
We have 830,000 members, and actually about 99,000 of those members are in California. So we're big fans of California.
Good.
And we also do have an office in California as well. We have a San Francisco office. I'm coming from the D.C. office right now.
All right.
Well, here's a question for Olivia. You asked other people to join us too, didn't you?
Yeah, we were looking for people to speak on behalf of the pesticides, but we didn't necessarily get through to them.
What happens when you call them?
They didn't really respond or call back.
Why do you think that is?
Probably because they shouldn't be on a show talking about the disadvantages of pesticides.
Well, don't you think that an industry that has become so dependent upon using them would be willing to stand up and speak for them?
Hmm. Maybe that's not how it appeared to them. Not sure.
What do you think, Madeline? Why don't they join us on the radio?
I think it is certainly a difficult issue for them to talk about. the evidence is clear that these chemicals do cause harm to pollinators and to other species in the environment and are having, you know, rippling effects throughout the ecosystem. And so with that much evidence pointing to that these are harmful, I think it's hard for them to defend their own products. They do a lot of really great work talking about building habitat and all the great things many of these companies are doing to build habitat, but they certainly tend to pivot away from talking about the direct impacts of these chemicals on pollinator populations.
Well, folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating World Radio. But we have an assistant host today. Her name is Olivia Duncan, and she is a senior at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and her guest, Madeline Carnamark, who is the pollinator program, easy for me to say, pollinator program and policy coordinator at the Center for Food Safety. And you, what do you think? Can we do both? Can we have pesticides and bees? 831-479-1080. Join us.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. Ah, you can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it. And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, thank you, Will Strickland. Michael Olson here. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Today we're talking about bees and pesticides. Can we have both? Can we grow our food and keep our pollinators alive? Because without our pollinators, we can't grow food. And it seems to be we put ourselves in a fix, whereas we can't grow food without our pesticides. So kind of worked ourselves into a fix. What are we going to do? With us today, we have co-host, UCSC intern producer, Olivia Duncan. And who's your guest?
We have Madeline Carnamark, Pollinator Program and Policy Coordinator at the Center for Food Safety, all the way in Washington, D.C. So we were wondering, to what extent are bees in danger?
So that's a good question. So we really, it takes breaking it down into sort of two categories. So we have honeybees, which I think is what most people think of when they think of bees. And those are your largely your managed honeybees is how we track those. And a survey done last year showed that about 44% of managed honeybee hives were lost in 1 year. So that's quite a loss. And if that was any other type of livestock, for example, you know, if cattle farmers were losing that number, 44% of their cows, I think people would be a lot more in shock, but it's sort of hard when it's put in the context of bees.
That's almost like General Custer at the Little Bighorn.
And then the other half of it is that there are native pollinators and wild bees. And so there are about 4,000 species of bees that are native to the U.S., and those are solitary bees, and those are a lot harder to track because they're not living in hives. We don't manage them. We can't. It's harder to know, but we do know that the same things that are impacting the managed honeybees, the pesticide impact, is also hurting those wild bees. And we saw this year the rusty patch bumblebee was listed as an endangered species, which was...
Right. How do you count the bees? How are you gathering this data? Do you go and in the field just counting one by one?
Well, for the solitary bees, that's really where the problem is. It's really hard to quantify, you know, the losses. They're solitary. They're very small. There's so many different varieties. And there's a lot of, you know, citizen scientists out there who are talking about bee decline and, you know, contributing to the data. But it's certainly much harder than with the managed honeybees, where a beekeeper can speak to how many of their hives they've lost.
So are the managed bees, you were saying, are those the ones that we use for our agriculture, or are the native ones also indirectly involved?
So the native ones are certainly indirectly involved. We have so much to thank for native pollinators. Wild bees are very efficient pollinators, and they're going to find their ways into our agricultural crops for sure. The managed honeybees are ones that we bring to crops to pollinate them. Again, I think a lot of people, when they think of honeybees, they're thinking about honey production, which is certainly like one factor of bees. But there's also, a farmer relies on bees coming to his farm to pollinate his crops. So beekeepers are traveling all across the country bringing their bees to do this vital service.
And can you tell us a little bit about colony collapse disorder?
Sure. You know, I think that's something that when the bee issue really started to happen about 10 years ago, it was sort of shrouded in mystery. People were like, why are these bees dying? They're starting to act very strange. They're not coming back to the hive. They're quite literally collapsing, and people didn't know why. And so they created colony collapse disorder as a term just to describe the general disappearance of bees, but not necessarily pinpoint it. I try to avoid really using that term only because I think there are things that we know are hurting the bees. There's certainly several factors, but we do know that pesticides are a leading cause of this decline. And sometimes I think CCD, colony collapse disorder, creates this continued narrative of that we're not sure what's happening, and it's happening to them mysteriously.
It's interesting because you're saying that we don't know what's happening, but you're also saying that pesticides are the leading cause. How do you know that pesticides are involved in this mystery?
So there are, I mean, the research that has been done over the past 10 years, there are studies after studies showing that these pesticides are harmful to bees and other pollinators. And what happens is that they, at very, very low doses, they perhaps won't kill off the bees directly. There are incidents of direct spray kills where these are insecticides. They're meant to kill insects. Bees are insects. But at low doses that they're applied, where it's supposed to be safe for bees, it's weakening their immune system over time. So that makes them far more susceptible to other things that are harmful, particularly to managed bees, like diseases in the hive, or mites, or fungus.
And how do neonicotinoids, specifically that kind of pesticide, impact bees?
Sure. So neonicotinoids are a class of systemic insecticides. And what that really means is that instead of being a pesticide that you use to apply directly to a pest problem or directly to an area to target that, what these do is that they actually move throughout the vascular system of the plant, rendering the entire plant toxic, including both the nectar and pollen. So bees really, once a plant has been treated, it's then a toxic entity that bees really can't avoid. And so there's a lot of efforts to have communication between farmers and beekeepers to, you know, move their hives when the actual spray is happening. But once the bees are then on those plants that have been treated, they're still going to be getting low doses of these insecticides.
Right. And neonicotinoids are also chemically related to nicotine. So is it pretty addictive then to bees or plants? I don't know.
So it's more the mode of action, the way they work in terms of being a neuron inhibitor. There was a study that did show that bees were not only did they not care that plants were treated and were certainly going to go to those plants anyways, they were sometimes actually more inclined to go to treated plants. Not exactly like a cigarette, but there is a correlation between the two.
And I'm going to jump here really quickly. With respect to the low dose interaction. It seems like what you're saying is that a low dose won't kill, but repeated low doses do have an impact. It's kind of like the food we eat, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think it's really hard, you know, to rally conservation efforts when we're talking about sublethal impacts. So, we're, you know, it's not something that's killing these bees outright, although that certainly does happen. You know, if you ever have the chance to host a beekeeper on the show, hearing the stories about some of these bee kills is really heart-wrenching to watch as, you know, their livelihoods are quite literally falling to the ground based on these sprays. But at low impacts, what it's really doing is just weakening the bees. And so, particularly in something like a managed honeybee living in a hive, they're so dependent on one another, small effects to, you know, they can sort of keep up with each other even if some are weaker, but that starts to have effects throughout the entire hive and make them more susceptible.
Also wondered about nutrition with respect to bees kept over winter. They're fed, what, sugar water, right?
Yeah, so different beekeepers do have different practices. It's an area, I think, that there's a lot of different practices for honeybees. It's something that certainly, as they decline, we're having to move the bees a lot more than they probably used to be. Just to get, for example, in California alone, 2/3 of the remaining honeybee population has to go to California to pollinate the almond crop. So that's bees coming from all across the country.
So it's just an interesting thought. I wonder what would happen to us if we lived on a diet of sugar water and then low doses of pesticide. I wonder how long it would take us to, like, wander off someplace and not come back. Well, this is a Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson with Olivia Duncan and Madeline Carnemark, who's the pollinator program and policy coordinator at the Center for Food Safety, and you. What do you think? Can we grow food without pollinators, or can we grow food without pesticides, or can we grow with both? 831-479-1080.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, there is more What's Eating What, and What's Eating What today is we're trying to figure out how to work our way out of this magnificent conundrum we found ourselves in. On one hand, we rely on the pollinators like the bees to pollinate 1/3 of the food that we eat. Every third bite, folks, pretty important critter those little pollinators are. And yet we have come to rely on a technology based on pesticides that kill those pollinators to grow the plants that we eat. So we're kind of in an interesting fix, don't you think? What are we going to do about it? Well, that's what the subject of today's Food Chain Radio program, co-hosted by Olivia Duncan, a senior of environmental studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Also, her guest today, she brought all the way from Washington, D.C., Madeline Carnemark, who is the pollinator program. And I'm going to get this right one time. Did you invent that name?
I know. Yeah. I wanted to make people struggle a little with all those P's.
Pollinator Program and Policy Coordinator at the Center for Food Safety. Olivia, take it away.
I wanted to go back a little about something you were saying. So a lot of beekeepers are losing their bees, and I think I saw some statistics saying California just last year lost 40% of their hives. And so when that happens, what do the beekeepers do? It's not like you can just go to a bee grocery store and get more bees. How do they supplement that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it's heartbreaking to when the beekeepers lose their bees. One, I mean, these are things they care for throughout the entire year. Again, like I was saying, it's beautiful to listen to beekeepers talk about their bees.
They become emotionally attached, don't they?
Absolutely. I think anyone would. I mean, one, bees are amazing. I don't know how much time either of y'all have spent in apiaries, but it's a pretty cool place to be. And they get attached, which, you know, is hard, but it's also, this is their livelihood at the end of the day. And so that's, you know, a heartbreaking reality when they die like this. So in terms of supplementing the bees, there's an entire industry of you know, raising bees for this purpose, and they do have to, and oftentimes, depending on where they are in the season, we're also seeing beekeepers having to either, you know, work with less bees or having to split their hives, and that makes the whole colony a little bit weaker. So that's moving less bees into more
good frames.
Okay. Also on that, what's the extent that pesticides are used in agriculture?
Now, how dependent are we on pesticides, Madeline? It seems to me like, why don't we just get rid of all pesticides? I mean, if you think about it, farmers would love to get rid of pesticides because they have to buy them, and what farmer in his right mind wants to buy something they don't need? None of them do.
Absolutely. I think, you know, particularly with that word dependent, in the current system in which we're in, it's certainly a chemically dependent system, the way that we're growing food and using those pesticides. But there, if we started to invest a lot of the same money that's going into pesticides into some of these agroecological alternatives, that there is certainly evidence that we can create similar yields and use far less chemicals than we're currently using. So how much are pesticides used? They're used widely throughout all of agriculture, particularly the class of insecticides that we've been talking a lot about, neonicotinoids. You know, they're on almost 100%, 90% of the corn that we grow in the country. This is pre-treated corn, and I think 50% of soybeans, and those are two of the biggest commodity crops. So they're definitely prevalent throughout agriculture, and they're finding them across the board in the environment, particularly in water bodies. We're seeing them.
So these plants that you speak of, corn and soybeans, are also more than likely to be genetically modified to contain a Bacillus thuringiensis pesticide. So you have a BT pesticide, sometimes two or three BT pesticides, mm-hmm. and then they're also using this neonicotinoids as well. So you have that within their systemic pesticides, so the neonics are inside the plant as well. Mm-hmm. So that each plant becomes kind of like, wow, a nuclear bomb.
Quite a cocktail at the end of the day, how many they all stack on top of each other. When they're applied to the plants, they're often called in tank mixes, and we're seeing these formulations of, you know, multiple pesticides and fungicides mixed together. Research has come out that shows that not only is that stacking multiple chemicals on top of those plants, but the chemicals can work synergistically with each other and make the chemicals more toxic. You're also finding, particularly with the advent of the systemic insecticides and the ability to treat seeds, which means that once the farmer gets the seeds, they've already been applied a pesticide sort of cocktail on top of them. So they go into the ground prior to any pest threat. And with those, you know, you get these seeds that you read the label, and the number of different things that have been applied to the seeds going before they even hit the ground is pretty crazy to read. I have to say, I had to read a seed label once, and it took me, 2 hours to get through.
Right. These are in...
Is that how you designed your position name, by reading those labels?
Yeah, I wanted something a little bit more difficult.
Okay.
So these pesticides are in commercially available products, right? And there's been some movement to warn and inform consumers of these pesticides, right?
Absolutely. So I think particularly in an ag-producing state like California, but across the board, it's hard for the average home grower to know the impact that they're having with the chemicals they're using in their own yard. It seems kind of underwhelming in comparison, but, you know, when we're looking at water bodies across the U.S. and looking at concentration levels of neonics in water, we're seeing that a lot of the highest concentrations are actually coming from urban runoff and ornamental uses. So the home grower is certainly an important part in this equation in helping pollinators. So there have been there's a movement. There is SB 602, which is the Pollinator Protection Act. It was reintroduced this year by Senator Ben Allen with a new co-sponsor, Senator Scott Wiener. And essentially what it's doing is in retail stores where you can buy these chemicals on the shelf, it's doing two things. First off, it's a two-pronged approach. So first, it's going to reduce exposure to bees by requiring labeling of all the retail plants and seeds that have been pre-treated with neonics. So that's, and then the second thing that it does is ensure that the pesticides are only available for sale to certified applicators, farmers, or veterinarians, which will prevent the overexposure and overuse for people who are not properly trained to use them.
So when we go to the nursery and buy a rose plant and take it home and put it in the ground, we could be killing bees.
Yeah, I think that's a, I think that's part of this is really just about the transparency. So for, you know, you could be someone who's aware of the bee issue or is trying to keep an organic garden, but so often what you don't know is even if you're not applying any chemicals to your own garden, the plants that you're buying at the nursery could have come pre-treated. And so what this is doing is forcing that there has to be a label on those plants saying that they have been pre-treated with neonicotinoids, indicating that those products harm bees, and then letting the consumer make the choice. You know, for some, maybe that's not something they're worried about and they want to continue on with using those plants. But I think that once given the option, I think a lot of retailers will start to look for varieties that aren't treated because you're going to find that most people want untreated plants and are interested in protecting bees.
Hey, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson, Olivia Duncan, and Madeline Carnemart. And you do stay tuned to 831-479-1080. Right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, Fodia, are you folks out there, are you guys hungry for food? We're such a hungry country and such a hungry world. Most of that food that we're eating now comes possible, one-third of it at least, is made possible by pollinators like bees. And yet we have a conflict here that has to be resolved, or maybe it doesn't. What is the conflict, Olivia?
Well, the conflict is that we rely, again, on bees so much for our food, but we've also become so dependent on pesticides. And it seems like we want to keep both, that is, to the industry. But obviously, bees are in decline, and I'm not sure these two can coexist. I don't know. What are we doing, Madeline? What do you think? What do you think is a good resolution for this? Madeline?
Hi.
Oh, hi.
Yeah, I think there, you know, I think that if we need to refocus and look at what the priorities are, it certainly is a, it would be a big transition to move away from this chemically dependent system. I think you'd find a lot, quite a bit of industry pushback from that. But I do think it's doable, and I think that so often in the equation people say, yeah, but could we do it and continue to feed people? We need, you know, at the end of the day, that's what we're looking to do. We need to feed people, growing population, what can we do? And what we're finding is that, yes, we absolutely can. There are organic farms that are thriving, and, you know, it's one of the most rising industries, and then also just looking at ways that we can be farming in smarter ways that maybe isn't 100% organic, but certainly reducing chemical usage. And as we kind of move down that path, we're not only going to be helping the bees, I think we're also going to be helping ourselves really reconnect with.
Well, but wait a minute here, Madeline. It seems like, from what I've read, we use neonics on 100 million acres of U.S. farmland. We've taught our farmers how to grow our food using pesticides. That's what they know how to do. Wouldn't it be a lot easier to do without the bees than to retrain all those farmers?
It's a pretty short-term plan, unfortunately. I mean, the bees not only
well,
are...
Well, in short-term, yes, it would be very easy. It would be much
easier.
It might
easier. Be easy to just say good riddance to the bees. Not only would that be a huge problem because we certainly need our pollinators for foods to pollinate the crops that the farmers are growing. You know, the two go side by side. The farmers can't do without them. So, but it also, really what we're seeing with the bees is, you know, it's an overused phrase, but it's the canary in the coal mine. These chemicals are having impacts across the ecosystem, not just for the bees. And, you know, bee decline, because it's so critical to agriculture, is something that's, you know, raising attention to the issue. But whether or not we want to say good riddance to the bees, which obviously probably wouldn't work either, we need to be looking at what are the larger repercussions of this chemically dependent system.
What happens if we get rid of the bees?
Well, you know, I'm not sure that Well, one in every 3 bites of food you eat is pollinated by bees, so you'd be eating a pretty bland diet, and that's also that one bite is probably your most nutritious bite. So, you know, the diet would change drastically in situations where bees have already declined. We're seeing in other countries, you know, people are having to go out and hand pollinate. I don't think that's something that, on the scale of use that we do in U.S. agriculture, that we could ever, you know, find a way to replace them.
You talk about the prophylactic use of pesticides like neonics, which is to say farmers go out into their field and spray the bleep out of everything just to make sure that nothing untoward will happen to their crops. So it's kind of like a preventative measure. And yet that seems to be the big problem we have. How easy do you think it would be to recondition the way our farmers think to avoid that prophylactic use?
I think farmers want to use the technology that's available to them, and I think that a lot of it would have to do with, you know, coming up with ways and talking to the farmers, getting out into the fields and working with them to do these transitions. So farmers have so much on their plate, and I think that it's really important that more funding is going into finding these alternatives, that they're becoming more mainstream, that, you know, you don't have, there's organic farmers that are certainly, you know, have great practices, but there's also, I think, an in-between for people that they don't have to take that full leap, and they can start to reduce the use. And what we're finding, for example, with soybeans, you know, farmers were noticing that the treated soy is not as increasing yield, and that it wasn't necessarily necessary. So then, you know, those seeds have to become available too. So, you know, they might buy untreated seeds, but it's really hard to find them. So for corn, it's almost impossible to find, you know, an untreated corn seed. So whether the farmer wants to use them or not is sometimes not even an option.
So you're talking very big money.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of money in the chemical industry.
And you're talking about the established way of doing things. So affecting any change in that's going to require some kind of real big deal. You're not going to be able to change that because it's all set up that way. It seems to me like, you know, we have taken people off the land, moved them all into the city, and replaced them with pesticides. Am I wrong?
About how much pesticides are in
about how
the
many about the loss of people out there in the field. You talk about, you know, organic farmers being able to do this without pesticides, but they do it because they're out there in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in conventional agriculture, one person can grow 1,000 acres of crops with no bugs. So don't we have to put people back on the field if into the land if we're going to do this?
Yeah, I think that there's still certainly lots of people out in the field, you know, using these practices. But yeah, it would be reinvesting, you know, putting a priority on the food that we're eating and the way that it's being grown. And it certainly would change things, you know, all of these.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
That's right. So much to say, so little time to say it. And here to help us say it, we have intern producer Olivia Duncan. Olivia, fire away.
So we've been talking about this conflict, right, of bees and pesticides. We rely on both. Is there a middle ground where bees and pesticides are involved?
You know, I don't think that the bees and pesticides go hand in hand well together. But I do think that there are ways that people can be working to protect bees even when all of this pesticide use is happening. So I think that, you know, building habitat, not using the pesticides in your own home gardens, finding ways to attract native pollinators to your garden, planting native plants, these are all really important. And so in the world where we're still using this heavy pesticide, I don't think we have the full solution yet on how to make this transition away from them. I think we know we need to go there. But in the meantime, you can be doing so much to be protecting pollinators, buying organic foods, and, you know, using your purchasing power to show where you want, which direction you want agriculture to go.
So really, we're looking at a situation where our purchasing decisions are not only for our own personal well-being, but for the well-being of everything.
Absolutely. You know, every day we have choices that we can make and where we're going to prioritize our money. You know, currently there are certainly organic food is a little bit more costly, but I think it's where you're taking that cost from is important to look at.
Evidently, you haven't heard of Michael Olson's third law of the food chain. Cheap food isn't.
That's a good one.
So, well, what do you think, Olivia?
About cheap food isn't?
No. But what do you think? You looked at this subject.
Right. Well, I was actually agree with Madeline. I was seeing how organic food, that increase in consumer interest is effective in this. But I'm also worried about accessibility to those, because being here in Santa Cruz, there's like 3 farmers markets going around within a few miles radius. But in other places, like food deserts, is that always a viable option for people, especially coming from diverse socioeconomic backgrounds? And I'm wondering how that would work on such a large scale if we significantly reduce the use of pesticides.
Well, Madeline, how are we going to talk everybody into this?
I think you know, there's momentum building, and there's ways that people can get involved other than just eating organic, and it certainly is an issue about accessibility, but it's the more that we keep moving in that direction, the more we're going to be investing in the agroecological methods and organic methods and starting to transition those farms, and these foods are going to become more readily available, which means that, you know, increased access. And there's other things, you know, people can be doing, things like the bill I was talking about, the Pollinator Protection Act in California. You know, call your senator, say that you support the bill, say, you know, you care about the bees. And the more that this becomes part of the conversation, that this is important to people, I think the best way to save the bees is to transition, you know, the way that we're growing our food.
And get a bumper sticker that says, save the bees.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just because you'll make a lot of friends.
Madeline, thank you so much for joining us. Madeline Karnemark, Pollinator Program and Policy Coordinator at the Center for Food Safety. Ha!
And
Olivia Duncan, thank you for so much for the past quarter of working with us on the Food Chain Radio Program. Now go out and have a great life, okay?
Thank you. It's
thank you
wonderful.
All for tuning in.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.